How to build your faith.
Six phases. We started 2 weeks ago with an overview, description of the six ways that the Lord uses to build your faith, starting with dream, then decision, delay, difficulty, dead end, and then at last, glorious deliverance. Well, last week we talked about how to get Krishna's dream for your life, and this is the second area for faith building, which is called how to make the right decisions. And these principles that we're going to talk about today can apply to, you know, all kinds of decisions in your life. What to speak of the most important decision is what to do with our life ultimately. So here's Vishnu lying down in his yoga nidra sleep, and as he dreams, from his pores and from his breathing come unlimited universes. And in those universes are impregnated uncountable living entities who have decided for one reason or another to separate themselves from God and come into this material world in order to eke out an independent existence. And the Lord's purpose in facilitating our desires is ultimately to rehabilitate us and get us back home, back to from where we came, back to home, back to Godhead. Therefore, the living entities in this material world will undergo, encounter circumstances which are arranged by Krishna in order that we may go back home, back to Godhead. Those circumstances are character building. We'll encounter problems, we'll encounter difficulties, and we'll encounter pressures, and they're all for our own good. God doesn't do anything without a purpose or a reason. And so the so-called difficulties that we encounter have a reason behind them. We just need to understand the process so that we can cooperate with it. If we don't understand these six phases of faith building, get God's dream for your life, make the right decision, put up with the delays, endure the difficulties while you're waiting, come to a dead end, come to an impossible situation where it's never going to happen, and then all of a sudden the light comes bursting through the clouds and you get deliverance. If you understand these six phases that God uses to build your faith, then you won't get confused or resentful or bitter, and most importantly, you won't miss God's plan for your life. You'll say, oh yeah, I'm in the difficulty phase, or I'm in the delay phase. And today we're going to talk about the second of the six phases, the decision phase. And it's based on the principle that we're not here by accident, that there's actually a purpose for our life, and we need to find out what it is, and then we need to act on it. You know, a lot of people may have a dream, but only one in ten is going to do something about that dream and act on it. If you have a dream, it's going to do you good and do others good, but you don't act upon that dream, you don't make a decision, then there's no good to that dream. In America, you know, we love decisive leaders, don't we? We have a love affair with decisive. People can make quick decisions. Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, do this. Yeah, go ahead. That's all right. You got my approval. Go right ahead with it. But in most cases, a quick decision is not going to be the right decision. Just because it's a quick decision, just because you see this person as being decisive, doesn't mean they're going to make the right decision. It doesn't take any aforethought. It doesn't take any depth to make a decision, but it takes a lot to make the right decision. And that's what we're going to talk about today. Here's a little joke. I don't know how well you can see it. How well can you see if you're sitting over there? Can you read that? Yeah, he says, I'm a man of my word. Once I've made a wrong decision, I stick to it. But what does it take to make a right decision? If we don't learn decisiveness, we're not going to get anything out of spiritual life. Decisiveness is a recipe for disaster. How many times have you been driving on the freeway and you come up to an exit and the driver who's just in front of you or to one side, he can't make up his mind or she can't make up his mind whether to continue on the freeway or whether to exit. And as a result of that indecisiveness, he creates a third lane going right into the traffic island. And you don't know, and he doesn't know or she doesn't know which way they're going to turn. And have you ever had that happen where someone all of a sudden they decide they're going to exit or they haven't been able to decide beforehand and all of a sudden they're just going to cut across three lanes of traffic because they have to take this exit? And that's a recipe for disaster. Indecisiveness is it's not like you can stay out of trouble by being indecisive. You often get into the worst kinds of trouble by failing to be decisive. And in scriptural authority it says double-mindedness, you know, trying to stay on two boards in the water When they're both floating in different directions, we'll end up with you getting very soaking wet. We need to make up our minds about what's important in our life, or otherwise we're going to court disaster. And the Bhagavad Gita starts with Arjuna trying to make a decision. He's got to make a decision. He's not having a very easy time of it. This is what he says right in the second chapter, fifth verse. He says this to Krishna, his friend, advisor, confidant, the Supreme Lord descended on the planet. Arjuna says to Krishna, nor do we know which is better, conquering them, the Kauravas who oppose Arjuna and the Pandavas on the battlefield, or being conquered by them. If we kill the sons of Dhritarashtra, we should not care to live, yet they are standing before us on this battlefield. So Arjuna's dilemma is that he represents the forces of good. The opposing armies represent the forces of evil. There's only one problem. What would otherwise be a pretty clear-cut situation is ambiguous. The waters are muddied by the fact that there's some very, very good people on the opposite side, that due to force of circumstances, they've had to throw in their lot with the evil-minded Duryodhana. And over and above that, Arjuna has a kinship with most of the soldiers on the other side. They are his cousin brothers, his nephews. Two of them, Bhisma and Dronacharya, are his dear teachers. And Arjuna says, I shouldn't be trying to kill them with arrows. I should be offering flowers and I should be offering incense to them. Because anything I know about character, about the art of war, whatever I am, has been due to their mentorship. And now I'm being asked to kill them. So I don't know which is better. He's indecisive. He says, I suppose they should be killed because they represent the forces of darkness. But at the same time, if I go ahead and kill them, then who wants to live without any of their friends or relatives? What kind of a life is that? When your prosperity and your freedom is bought at the cost of the demise of your teachers, your cousins, and those who you respect. So this is tough, you know, this is really tough. And it's very tempting not to make a decision. It's very tempting because Arjuna can't see any good coming out of it. If he turns this way or he turns, he can't see any good. So he's tempted just to go into the forest. But Krishna says not to make a decision is to make a decision. And Krishna threatens Arjuna with dire consequences. He says, If you give in to this indecisiveness, he says, and do not perform your duty of fighting, then you will incur sins and lose your reputation as a fighter. People will always speak of your infamy, and for a respectable person, dishonor is worse than death. But Krishna closes that door. He slams the door. He says, you've got to do something. And your duty is to fight. Otherwise, if we don't pick up and understand what our duty is, I mean, we've all got personal duties to our family and our friends and our country. Some of you might be students and you have homework assignments and papers due. Some of you are employed and so you have to owe a certain fealty to your boss and to your supervisors. Some of you have family members that you have to take care of. These are called shradharma. They're temporal duties which adhere to each individual based on his bodily circumstances. But there's a higher duty called Sanatana Dharma, which is the duty of the soul vis-a-vis God. And we all exercise that duty in different ways, depending on the talents that God has given us. We all have spiritual gifts, we have abilities, we have a unique personality, and we all have had experiences in our life which make us what we are. And when we take this sum total and we offer it to God, then we catch up God's plan for our lives. And if we don't do that, then we're just like this fellow in the picture here. Oh, what to do, what to do. He'll never grow in character. What are the principles behind making a wise decision? There's spiritual principles for making career decisions, marriage decisions, financial decisions, health decisions, decisions about your children, decisions about your future. The decisions that we make can never be underestimated. You are what you are where you are because of the decisions that you've made in life. And if you think you can just go through life without making decisions, that's also put you in a certain place too. And it's not a good place. Decisions determine our destiny, and the choices that we make determine our characters. So the difference between people who fulfill their destiny and who build their character and those who don't are those that they see, they have a dream, they have a vision, they have an inspiration based on what they're put here for, what their unique talents and abilities and what their purpose is, and they go for it. They go for it. And those that don't do it, they sit, they soak, and they sour. So what are those principles? The first principle is pray for guidance. Pray for guidance. Don't trust yourself. It said the heart is deceitful above all things. Don't trust yourself. Trust in God, but don't trust in yourself. You know, we have impressions, we have intuitions, we have gut feelings, and those are, you know, those might lead you to go further down the road that you need to take in order to come up with a wise decision. But if you make a decision based on these superficialities, intuition, and gut feeling, and impressions, you're in 99 times out of 100, you're setting yourself up for disaster. We need to base our decisions on the rock-solid foundation of the Absolute Truth. This is the Bhagavad Gita as it is, spoken 5,100 years ago by Krishna to Arjuna, and he addresses the whole issue of indecision and decisiveness in 700 verses. And he resolves Arjuna's doubts, which we'll see later on. That on his own, researching and drawing upon all of his intuition, and all of his gut feelings, and all of his impressions, Arjuna just became more and more bewildered. This great, great, powerful warrior, drawing on all the resources that he had at his disposal, the result was paralysis. Krishna, I am confused about my duty. I have lost all power due to weakness. He couldn't even hold his bow. His bow just dropped. So we're all going to come to a point like that, where we rack our brains, we plumb our character, and we just there's no answer based on the resources that we have as individuals. And so we need to ask for guidance. Just like Arjuna, his indecisiveness was cleared up as soon as he put the matter to the Absolute Truth, Krishna. And the second thing we need to do is get the facts. You know, there's no contradiction between faith and facts. You know, it's not that I believe, and then but you don't get the facts. You know, if you believe, then go ahead and get the facts and back up what you believe. That's what facts are for. Don't act out of uneducated enthusiasm. You know that 90% of all businesses fail within the first year, and 90% of all those businesses fail within 5 years. And love also can be uneducated enthusiasm. 41% of all first marriages fail. It's a good idea, you know, when you come to the church or the temple and you have marriage in mind, to talk it over, to get the facts, to find out all the pitfalls. Earlier this year we gave our series of talks on love. And one of them was about how to keep a marriage going for 40 or 50 years. And we talked about the deadly D's. And you need to know what these are in advance. Everyone who wants to get married should have counseling to know that these are going to happen. Demands, difficulties, debt, depression. There's about 20 of them. They're the deadly D's. And you need to know what they are. You need to have a plan for dealing with them. Otherwise, you're going to meet with the worst D of all, which is called divorce. So uneducated enthusiasm should be avoided, both in the business world as well as in married life. Henry Ford said, good decisions are based on experience. Would you say that's true? If you've had experience, you can make a wise decision, all right? So how do you get the experience that you need in order to make a wise decision? You make a lot of stupid decisions. So it's good when you have an experience and you learn from it and you don't repeat it. How many of you have said something to your wife, your children, or your roommates, your husband, and then you've just like, oh my gosh, I wish I hadn't said that. That was really stupid, you know. And you said, I got to learn from that experience. I got to learn from that. I can't. And then 2 weeks later, you do the same thing again. Isn't it frustrating? Because you have to go, if you don't learn the lesson, you have to go over and over and over and come back to it again and again and again and again. So a wise man is one who learns from his experiences. But an even wiser man is one who learns from other people's experiences. And that's why a wise person, you know the measure of a person's wisdom? You know the measure, you know how to tell how wise a person is? By the people that he gets advice from. By how wise are the people from whom he seeks counsel. Arjuna is an ordinary person. Is an ordinary person. I mean, you don't see any incisive, you know, problem solver here in Arjuna. He doesn't have a PhD in clinical psychology. Or, you know, he's just an ordinary person. But he gets advice from the Supreme Personality of Godhead who happens to be his friend. So that way he comes out in the best possible way that he could. This is also a quote from Henry Ford. Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're both right. If you think you can do it, then you can do it. If you think you can't do it, then you can't do it. It all comes from your mental attitude. But life is too short for trial and error, and there's not enough time to learn everything from personal experience. So save yourself time, save yourself trouble, and go to other people and seek advice. It's the only way to get anywhere in this short space of 60 or 70 years. You can't reinvent the wheel. You can't learn everything by trial and error. Those people who seek advice from the right sources are those people who are going to navigate the difficult waters of life and come up with a plan for their lives. A lot of problems arise from the fact that we would rather appear to be wise than to actually be wise. And I'm looking at all the men in the room here. You know, men are like five times less likely to ask directions than women when they're lost. I think Vaibhavi and I had this experience just the other day. She said, why don't you stop and ask directions? And what she didn't realize was that I was perfectly willing to stop and ask directions, but there was no one in the street to ask directions for. So she's saying, stop and ask directions, stop and ask directions, you know, and I wasn't stopping to ask directions because there was no one to ask directions for. When I saw someone, then I finally didn't stop and ask directions. So there's no substitute for wisdom. You can't fake it, you know. You can't fake it. And if you're not willing to ask advice or directions from someone, then you've got an ego problem. And if you've got an ego problem, if you're arrogant, then you're just stupid. You're just stupid. You know, how many people are so smart that they're stupid? You know people like that? They're actually smart. They actually have a good high IQ. But they're so arrogant that they'll never ask anyone else for advice. They're so smart that they're stupid. And they just discount ordinary people. They just discount us. You know, they're so much smarter than we are. And they always end up on the rocks. You have to first of all start with the realization, the acknowledgement that we're all ignorant. You know, no one of us knows everything. In fact, each one of us knows very little. But everybody is knowledgeable on a different subject. So we need each other. If you put everyone together, there's a great body of knowledge available. You just need to interrelate and react and take advantage of it. And it should be face to face, not, you know, virtual. Should be real face to face empathetic advice, you know, from someone you know, not virtual advice through the internet or Facebook. So wisdom and humility go together. The next principle for making the right decision is calculate the cost. There is a cost for everything. Even 5 seconds of your time, that's pricey. That's pricey. We live for 22,000 days, based on a 60s song of the Moody Blues by the same title. We, each one of us, live for 22,000 days. So when you make a decision, how many seconds, how many minutes, how many hours, how many days, how many months, and how many times have we made a decision that's literally going to consume years of our life, and we've made the decision in like 30 seconds? How many times have we done that? What to speak of years in our life? Every second of our life is so valuable that we cannot buy it back with even millions and millions of golden coins. Everything has a price tag, even the most insignificant decision. You know, I'll go down to the grocery store to get a roll of toilet paper. And then you come back. This happens here. Yashoda should be here. She would benefit from this. So many times I get back from the grocery store, I buy all the things that she wants, and she says, "Oh, we need this." I say, "Yashoda, I just got back from the grocery store." You know, let's list down all the things we need so that we make one. So we get into, 1,000 pounds of metal and fire it up and pay $2.50 for a gallon of gas and spend an hour of our life. If we're going to do that, let's just do it once a week instead of five times a day. Does that make sense to you? Because there's a price tag for everything. Not only in terms of petrol and consumption, but the main thing that you're spending is the days and seconds and hours of your life. Chanakya Pandit lived 300 years before Christ, and this is his realization about that's pretty dark, isn't it? Well, anyway, he says the value of each moment is so great that it cannot be regained even by spending thousands of golden coins. Every single value, every single moment of your life. To decide without deliberating, to make a hasty decision, is a trap. To promise without pondering is a trap. It's okay to say, if someone's pressuring you to make a hasty decision, it's okay to say, "I'll get back to you. I'll get back." Because it's more important to make a right decision than it is to make a quick decision. Davy Crockett, that old American pioneer, he cautioned us, "Look before you leap. Very, very good advice. Have you found that it's easier to get into a relationship than to get out of a relationship? Have you found that true? Have you found it's easier to get into debt than to get out of debt? Have you found it's easier to fill your schedule than it is to fulfill your schedule? So it's easy to get in, but it's harder to get out. There's a story in the Mahabharata about Abhimanyu. Abhimanyu was in the womb of his mother, and he was listening from within the womb of his mother an elaborate description how, during the course of battle, if the enemy has formed itself in a chakra-vyuha, there are various formations. No, that's okay. Thank you, but I should have done that beforehand. There are various formations in those days when cavalry, elephant, infantry, and chariot soldiers would muster themselves, and they'd make various formations for chewing up the enemy ranks. And one of those formations was the chakra-vyuha, where the soldiers, the whole army would get in the shape of a wheel, and it would just start turning, and it would go and just chew up the enemy ranks. But if someone could penetrate in there, then they would disrupt the whole enemy and foil their plans for the day. So Abhimanyu, as a child within the womb of his mother, he heard the description from some warriors how to get in. But then they walked out of the room, or his mother walked out of the room. These warriors were saying, they had the secret, how do you get in? And then when they started talking about how you get out again, his mother walked out of the womb, and he was in the womb, so he couldn't say, "Mama, I want to stay." So 16 years later, during the Battle of Kurukshetra, Abhimanyu remembered how to get in. And he did it. His army, the pious Pandavas, were being decimated by this formation on the part of the Kauravas. The war lasted 18 days, and on one of the days, in the early stages of the war, it looked like the Pandavas were going to lose. Because they were just being decimated. 10,000 soldiers a day were being killed by this formation. So Abhimanyu remembered, "Aha, I know how to get in." So he went in, 16-year-old boy, he went in, and he disrupted the attack of the Kauravas and saved the day. Unfortunately, he didn't know how to get out. So if you can see this picture, it's a little dark. But he's inside of a whole army of like 4 million soldiers. And they've got to get him out. It's like, you've got to, when you get a thorn, you have to take a thorn out. So the 16-year-old boy was a thorn in the side of the whole Kaurava army. And they ganged up on him. 7 big Maharajas ganged up on this 16-year-old boy and killed him. It was easier for him to get in than it was for him to get out. You know, we had last Sunday, Brian parked his truck up in the asphalt here and left it in neutral. And he didn't realize it wasn't quite flat, so the truck rolled down the hill and took out half of Hunneman's office down there, as well as a tool shed. So what was the first thing? What did we do? We called various contractors, right? And we asked them to come to the scene, and we asked them to do what? To give us a what? An estimate. Now, is any contractor or carpenter going to do a job without sitting down and working out all the figures and giving an estimate? You think he's just going to give something off the top of his head? He's going to do all of his math, do all of his calculation, figure out what it costs, what the materials, what the labor. He's going to factor in some things that he hasn't foreseen, and then he's going to add on a profit. That's the only way to do business, to make sure that you have the income that you need in order to do a good job for your client as well as to support your own wife and children. That's what an estimate is all about. Every contractor does this. No king or no executive head goes to war without first of all making an estimate. Well, how many soldiers can we afford to lose? Because you will lose soldiers. No one ever went to war and never lost soldiers. So it's not a question of going to war and not losing soldiers. It's a question of how many soldiers you're going to lose, and then can you still win the war? H.L. Hunt, who was one of the first billionaires in America, said life consists of two things in life. First of all, is decide what you want, what it's worth your time, what you want, and the second thing is what is it, what do you want to pay for it? Decide what you want and what you want to pay for it. And Donald Trump gave some very wise advice also. By way of preparing for the problems that are going to come up during the course of this decision-making process, he said, expect the best, but prepare for the worst. A sensible man watches for problems ahead and prepares to meet them. And a simpleton does not, and he faces the consequences. You know Murphy's Law, that if anything can go wrong, it will go wrong. Here's a license plate. I don't know how well you can see it, but it said Murphy was an optimist. Murphy was an optimist. It's a sign of an intelligent man that he envisions what's the worst thing that can go wrong and then hedges against it. And Duryodhan, although he was evil, he was not dumb. Duryodhan was the head of the Kaurava army. He represented the force of darknesses, but that doesn't mean he was dumb. He went up to his leading general. This is Duryodhan here, and Bhishma, very hard to see, but Bhishma is the white-haired gentleman. And Duryodhan went up to Bhishma, and he said, "O my teacher, behold the great army of the sons of Pandu, so expertly arranged by your intelligent disciple, Drishtadyumna." He's talking to Bhishma, and he's talking to Dronacharya also. Now, the Kauravas outnumbered the Pandavas. They outnumbered them, three to two. For every two soldiers the Pandavas had, the Kauravas had three soldiers. And Duryodhan had the best warriors on his side. He had Dronacharya and Bhishma, and he also had Karna. And these were the best warriors. They were better than any of the warriors on the Pandava side, except maybe Arjuna. And yet he's not taking it for granted. He's still considering, with superior forces, with superior warriors, what can go wrong? And what can I do to hedge it up? What can I do to increase our chances of winning? In spite of the overwhelming advantages he already has, what can I do to increase our advantages? So he goes to Dronacharya. Now Dronacharya trained up all the young people. He trained them all in the art of warfare. It's an interesting story. When Dronacharya was young, he lived in the forest, and he was a Brahmin. Into that hermitage in the forest where he and his Brahminical father lived came a king who had been exiled from his kingdom. His name was Draupada. He had been exiled from his kingdom, and he lived in exile with Dronacharya, and they were friends. They were friends as kids, and they had a lot of adventures together. And Draupada would always say to Dronacharya, "When I get my kingdom back, I'm going to give you half. I'm going to give you half." And Dronacharya was a Brahmin, and Brahmins don't care for material possessions. But in that association, hearing those repeated promises, Dronacharya became a little polluted. Brahmins don't want possessorship or ownership. But he changed in the association of this worldly-minded warrior, and he actually began to look forward to having half of the kingdom. Well, what happened was, when Draupada's kingdom was restored to him, and Dronacharya went and reminded him of his promise, he denied it. He said, "Oh, I never promised you half the kingdom." And this like hit Dronacharya like a knife in his heart. Like a knife in his heart. And he was from the Brahminical, the peaceful caste. But then he just wanted revenge. And he learned all the military arts and he trained up all the young Kauravas and the Pandavas, his cousin brother. He trained them all up to be great warriors. And then what happened? At the end of the training, the student goes to the teacher and says, "What can I give you?" There was no salary, but there was dakshina. "What can I give you in appreciation of your teaching?" And this was Dronacharya's whole plan from the very beginning. That when these young warriors came up to him, and they said, "What can we give you as dakshina?" He said, "I want you to attack the kingdom of Draupada and bring him to me tied up in ropes." So with the skills that he had imparted to them, they did it. They besieged the city, they defeated Draupada, they tied him up, and they brought him. And then Dronacharya got his revenge. He said, "You promised me so many times that you would give me half the kingdom, and you didn't do it. Now I've got your whole kingdom, and you're tied up at my feet. I'll be a bigger man than you were. You can have half." He got his revenge. The problem is, in every victory, there's the seeds of a future defeat. That's the problem. In every victory, there's the seeds of a future defeat. So now, Draupada, he wanted revenge. It never ends. Gandhi said, "An eye for an eye, the whole world becomes blind." So Draupada, all he could think of was getting back now at Dronacharya. And so he did a sacrifice. He went into the forest, he did austerities, he did penances, he did a sacrifice, and the purpose of his sacrifice was to get a son that would kill Dronacharya in battle. And he got a son and a daughter. His name was Draupada, so he got the daughter Draupadi, who later married the Pandavas. She came out of the sacrificial fire. They were not born from any womb. And then out of the sacrificial fire came Drishtadyumna. Drishtadyumna. And Drishtadyumna was brought into this world for the purpose of killing Dronacharya. So Duryodhana very, very intelligently goes up to Dronacharya and he says, "Just see the opposite forces so expertly arranged by your disciple, Drishtadyumna." In other words, he was hinting to Dronacharya that Drishtadyumna will kill you. Just to put his top generals on their guard. So prepare for the best, but expect the best, but prepare for the worst. Now at this stage, we shouldn't confuse decision-making with problem-solving. If you have to have every problem solved in advance, you'll never make a decision. When you stood before the altar, if you're married, and said, "I do," you didn't have all the problems of 50 years of marriage solved in advance, did you? You didn't have those. But when you said, "I do," you made a decision that you would face those problems together and deal with them one by one. If you are impeded from making a decision by the thought that things are going to come up that you have not foreseen, you'll never make a decision. So don't confuse problem solving with decision making. You cannot solve all the problems of life in advance. If you even think about it, you become paralyzed, you know. It's like Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, "Sarva dharmam parityagya, mam ekam saranam vraja." He says, "Give up all varieties and come to me." I was raised as a Christian. I went to the Christian church in Pennsylvania, Episcopalian church. And yet I never really felt like that they had made Krishna or God real to me. I mean, I was not convinced by anything that any of the Christian preachers said from the pulpit. And when I went to prep school and boarding school in New Jersey, we had a lot of good preachers come on Sunday from Harvard and Yale and all, and they would give the sermons. And that just all rolled off me like water off a duck's back. So I wasn't really a Christian, although I had all the lore and the Bible stories, you know, had been told to me and I was familiar with them. But when I met devotees, Krishna devotees, in downtown Sydney, Australia in 1970, the first few sentences that devotee said to me, I realized two things. That this is a person who doesn't smoke, who doesn't drink, who doesn't eat meat. So this is a person with some potency. My Episcopalian priest had to go to the hospital for alcoholism, and he also smoked cigarettes. So it occurred to me that maybe he didn't have the spiritual potency that he should have had. And this devotee had potency. He was practicing what he preached. And then the level of knowledge that he gave me in those few minutes was higher than anything that I recall getting in all of my Christian background. So I didn't at that point reject Christianity, but I accepted that here was a higher level of knowledge. I didn't know everything that was it entailed, but here was something that I hadn't got anywhere else. And so I stepped up to that level of knowledge. And I started going to the temple in Australia. My Bobby will tell you, we had an apartment which was not too far from the rented temple. And we just went along because I was getting some information that I hadn't gotten before. And our purpose in being in Australia was just to earn money. She was a waitress, I was working in construction. And we had a prearranged, preset amount of money that we wanted to earn throughout 6 months in Australia, and then we would go traveling, continue traveling. And we just went to the temple because it was interesting. I had no idea of becoming a devotee. And in fact, I told myself that Upendra would give the lectures on Sundays and then during the week. And there would be questions. He always say, are there any questions or comments? Just like Prabhupada. And it seemed to me that every time anyone asked a question, he had the answer. He did, you know, based on the worldview, the paradigm of Krishna consciousness, he knew exactly what to say. It was like he saw the answers. And I thought, well, this is interesting, you know. And I will continue to go to the temple. I will continue to patronize the temple as long as he can answer the questions. But when someone asks him a question that he can't answer, then I'm off the hook. I felt that I would be off the hook. That I've come to a dead end or a black hole or something in Krishna. And then I would be free to go and, you know, go to something higher. That never happened. It never happened. This is 40 years later and every question has been answered. But still, theoretically, that if someone had more information, I'm open. That's what Krishna says. Give up all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. If you're too much caught up in religion and rules and regulations, and you because of that miss the chance to awaken your relationship with Krishna, then you're missing the point altogether. Even Prabhupada, he says, if you have a better idea of God, I will accept it. Nobody in the history of the Western world has ever delivered as complete information about God as Prabhupada. Krishna's name and address, phone, Prabhupada said, we'll even give you his phone number. All the detail, all the specifics. And yet still, we need to be open-minded enough to recognize that if someone can give a better conception, we'll take it. We're not going to be locked in to a dogma. But we want to know God. That's the whole point. That's what religion's all about. Prabhupada, I arranged the media appearances for Prabhupada in Australia. He visited Australia twice, I think, when I was there, between 70 and 75. And I arranged for him to go on national TV shows. And eventually he told me not to do it anymore because they were too short. There would be a million people watching, but number one, he said, they don't know how to question. They don't know how to ask the right spiritual questions. And number two, they would only have Prabhupada on for 2 minutes. And he'd rather speak to 10 people for half an hour and give them something substantial than speak to a million people for 2 minutes. But anyway, he went on this one show called Mike Willacy. And Mike Willacy was here, and Prabhupada sat here. It was a seat like this for two people, and he had a picture of Krishna. And he sat here and put the picture of Krishna on the seat, and there was Mike Willacy. And Mike Willacy was a very, very acerbic host. He would always try to attack his guests. And they said nobody came out of the Mike Willacy show. He wasn't wounded, bleeding from several wounds. So Mike Willacy said, so this is your Hindu idea of God, huh? And Prabhupada said, no, this is God. This is God. Well, he said, it looks like a Hindu God to me. Prabhupada said, well, what, if you want to refute this, then give me from your own scriptures, then tell me from Bible, you're a Christian, yes. So tell me from your own scripture what God looks like. If you want to reject this, then you tell me, you give me the better conception. He's Sham. Not black, not exactly bluish, but Sham is the color. Sham means the color of a monsoon cloud during the rainy season. And he's Navayovanam Cha. He's ever youthful. Would God be old? What force could make God grow old? He's in charge of matter. He's in charge of time. These things cannot make God grow old. So he is Navayo, he is ever youthful. Kandarpa Koti Kamaniya. His beauty is so great that millions of cupids are defeated by him. He wears a peacock feather in his hair. The Vajanti garland swings around his neck. And he's always Chintamani Pakarasadma Shukalpavra, surrounded by hundreds of thousands of goddesses of fortune. This is not Hindu idea of God. This is the best idea of God. And if you have a better one, then here we are on national TV in front of 2 million people. You give me a better, I'll surrender. Otherwise, you should surrender. Prabhupada said like that. He said, you've got, you know, 30, it wasn't exactly like that, but he said, you're right, you've got 30 seconds. He was right. You know, if you don't know who God is, you cannot say that Krishna is not God. In fact, if Krishna fits the definitions, then you have to accept that he's God. But we're living in a world of such theological and hypocritical dishonesty that even though we're presenting this every single week, we even have our internet radio station. We're presenting this every single week, week after week after week. People just come and go. So little interested are they in actually finding the truth and making the decision that will make their life meaningful. I'm not saying you make a decision based on what I say, but you get the facts. You pray for guidance. You investigate. And you will conclude that Krishna is God. You will conclude that, just like I did 40 years ago, and still stick to that idea. He meets the qualifications. It's not just a dogma. Sarvadhamman Parita. Krishna invites you. Krishna challenges. Give up all varieties of religion and just surrender unto me. In return, I will protect you from all sinful reaction. Do not fear. So part of your decision-making process is to trust God in all circumstances and to give your problems to Him. You cannot solve all the problems in advance. All you can do is say, Krishna, you are the best conception that there is, that I know of on the planet. So I'm giving what I know of me to what I know of you. That's the best you can do. I'm giving what I know of me to what I know of you. And I trust you to guide me and to protect me and to reveal more as time goes on. This is basically the text of the Bhagavad Gita. This is what Krishna told Arjuna. And at the end of the 700 verses, from a point of paralysis and confusion and weakness, just see what Arjuna says now. He's no longer racked with indecision. He's made his decision. He says, I put my doubt before you, Krishna. Only you, because you are infallible, because you see past, present, and future, you're the only one that can dispel my doubt. And Arjuna repeatedly refers to Krishna as Madhusudana, the destroyer of doubt. And he puts it to Krishna, not an ordinary man, not a fellow confusee, but he puts it to Krishna because Krishna has the vantage point, the perspective to see everything. And Krishna has his chain of disciplic succession. In the Bhagavad Gita, it's advised, just try to learn the truth by approaching a self-realized soul. Render service unto him and inquire from him submissively. The self-realized soul can impart knowledge unto you because he has seen the truth. Notice the chronology here. Approach the self-realized soul, render service, and inquire submissively. Render service and inquire submissively. By approaching Prabhupada and acknowledging that he's giving a higher level of knowledge about God, and then render service to him, then the answers come. Then the spiritual master will be pleased to impart knowledge unto you. Otherwise, if you just want to sit and get everything worked out in advance, well, I'm not going to surrender until I have all my doubts resolved in advance. I'm not going to surrender until I know everything that's all chalked out in me. That won't work. You identify a realized soul as far as you can tell. You render service, and then you submit inquiries. Love of God is not taught, it's caught. It's caught. It's not an apodictic process. It's a question of sadhusang, or association. And think of the deal. In making the decision to follow Krishna, think of the deal Krishna offers. If you go through and plumb the Bhagavad Gita and pull them out, Krishna offers such a deal for those who decide to serve him. He offers 8 benefits and only asks 2 from us. Why does he give us such a deal? Because he wants to bring us back home, back to God. He misses us. Father has 10 sons. 9 of them are very successful and 1 of them is in trouble. Which one does the father think about more often? Which one does the father expend more energy on behalf of? So Krishna is very eager to rescue us, and so he gives us such a deal. If you go through the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna promises these 8 things. He says he will rescue us from this ocean of birth and death. He will rescue you and bring you back to the eternal spiritual world where there's no birth, death, disease, and old age. He will protect you. I mentioned before, Arjuna was not the greatest warrior. He was outnumbered and he was outmanned. But throughout the 18 days of the Kurukshetra War, Krishna protected him. He crossed that dangerous ocean. The Kurukshetra War was like an ocean in which there were many, many sharks and man-eaters. And they all wanted to kill Arjuna, but he came across because Krishna protected him. And then Krishna says, I will answer him. You know, Arjuna asks a couple of questions, and Krishna gives 700 verses. You think that's a good answer? You think that shows concern? That Krishna really wants to educate Arjuna and dispel all ignorance from him? He answered him. I will be with him. What is Krishna doing here? He's driving the chariot of Arjuna. God is driving the chariot of his devotee. If you don't feel God present in your life, guess who moved? It's us who walk away from him, but he never walks away from you. He promises he will always be with you. And then I will deliver him and I will honor him. Arjuna, I mentioned, he wasn't the greatest warrior. He wasn't the topmost warrior. But 5,000 years later, in Spanish Fork, Utah, as well as all over, we're talking about Arjuna. We're talking about Arjuna because Krishna is the most famous and Arjuna is the friend of Krishna. And by association, Arjuna also becomes the most famous. So therefore, 5,000 years ago, Krishna has honored Arjuna because it was to Arjuna that Krishna imparted. Welcome. The Bhagavad Gita and to no one else. With long life will I satisfy him and I will show him my salvation. And what do we have to do to take advantage of these 8 benefits? Rescue, protection, answering us, being with us, delivering us, honor, long life, and salvation. You only have to do 2 things. Just love Krishna and chant his holy names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That was painless, wasn't it? No blood anywhere. And we're not even charging a fee, unlike some yogis who charge a week's salary to get some secret mantra. And we're taking it out to the streets in Westwood Village and Times Square and Soho Street. Free gift, the most valuable thing. You call upon Krishna's name, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama. You love him, and in return, he will rescue you, he will protect you, he will answer you, he will be with you, he will deliver you, he will honor you. He'll give you long life and he'll show you salvation. The last thing, I believe this is the last thing, is face your fear. Because indecision is rooted in fear. Fear of failure, fear of embarrassment, fear that you'll make a mistake, fear that someone's going to laugh at me and reject me because of my commitment. And so we make excuses rather than just admit, I'm afraid. We'll say anything other than just, I'm afraid. Krishna has a dream for your life and he wants to be a part of it. So some of you are saying, well, I don't have the time, I don't have the money, I don't have the experience, I don't have the education, I don't have the contacts, I don't have the resources. If only I were married, I could serve Krishna. Or if only I were unmarried, I could serve Krishna. only I were older, I could serve Krishna. If only I were younger, I could serve Krishna. If I were in another country. You know, we get all these emails. Not a day passes. I don't get an email from some devotee in India. It's from Calcutta or Delhi or Bangalore. And he's saying, Prabhu, you just sponsor my green card and enable me to come and serve in America. I want to. I had a dream last night. I had a dream. Krishna was telling me to come and serve in America. I write back. I say that, you know, your dream is to come and make money. Your dream is to get the bucks. There's so much service to do in India. There's no such thing as, you know, coming to do service in America as superior to doing service in India. This is not the dream that Krishna has for your life. You're born in India, so you serve your countrymen by spreading Krishna consciousness. You're wanting to come to America has nothing to do with serving Krishna. You just want to come to America, get your green card, and then leave Krishna consciousness for a life of materialism. So this is all due to fear that Krishna will not keep his end of the bargain. We want to make our own separate arrangements, not completely trusting Krishna to take care of us. And if we wait for a perfect situation, it'll never happen. If you're waiting for the perfect husband, got news for you. He ain't coming. If you're waiting for the perfect wife, got news for you. It doesn't exist. If you're waiting for the perfect business opportunity, it's not going to happen. If you're holding out for protection, for perfection, that will paralyze perfection. Krishna has always used imperfect people in imperfect situations to get something done. Commitments have to be made, not in an ideal situation, but right in the middle of the stuff of life. Prabhupada met his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, in 1922. And Prabhupada was a follower of Gandhi, and India was colonized by the British. So when Prabhupada came in, and he offered his obeisances, right away, the first words out of Bhaktisiddhanta's mouth are, you're an educated young boy, why don't you take up Lord Chaitanya's message and preach in the Western world? That's the first thing his guru said to him. And Prabhupada says, I argued with him. He said, well, first we need to get our freedom. Because as a colonized country under Britain, people won't take us seriously. So let's get our freedom first, then people will take us seriously. Bhaktisiddhanta, he didn't care for the perfect situation. He wanted to use imperfect people in an imperfect situation. Even Lord Chaitanya, 500 years ago, he spread Krishna consciousness and everything was under the Muslims. Very, very repressive regime. And yet Lord Chaitanya was not intimidated. He went in, he took that imperfect situation and nevertheless he went and trusted Krishna and spread the Sankirtan movement all over India and predicted that eventually it would go to every town and village in the world. So Prabhupada says he argued with his guru upon the first meeting, and then he said, Bhaktisiddhanta defeated him. He said, we're not going to wait. The message is too important, and God is too powerful, that we don't need to be paralyzed by these less than perfect situations. The antidote to fear is faith. If Krishna is for you, who can be against you? So just whenever there's a storm, you can't go away from the storm. You can't turn in a different direction. The storm will hit you and capsize. You have to go right for it. So face your fears. Move against the fear. When you don't have the faith for something, just go ahead and do it anyway. And Krishna will give it to you. In World War I, there was a recruiting poster for the services. And they had a picture of someone in uniform. And they're pointing out and they're saying, you just put the uniform on, it'll tell you what to do. Put the uniform on, it will tell you what to do. So if you don't have the faith, just go ahead and do it anyway, and you'll get the faith. You know, our process is rising early in the morning and worshiping the deity. And if you're not used to rising early in the morning, that may be difficult at first. But you just do it anyway. And before long, you thrill. You jump out of bed. You can't wait to rush into the temple room, see the deity, offer the Mangalarti and hear the Madanga drums and the kartals and the singing. That's what happens if you just go ahead and do it. Then the spirit will follow. In 1950, this is what? 22, 32, 42, 50. Almost 30 years, 28 years after he met his spiritual master, Prabhupada Prabhupada wanted to fulfill the orders of his spiritual master, but he also wanted to be a householder. He wanted to do both. He wanted to preach in the Western countries, but he wanted to be a householder. So he didn't exactly know how he could do that, but he was doing some things, you know, arranging for printing of books and so on and so forth. But Bhaktisiddhanta came to him in a dream and told him, you can't do both. You can't remain a householder and preach. And at that point, his family was growing up anyway. His kids, his boys were educated and they were married. So there really wasn't any reason for him to stay in householder life. But still, Prabhupada says that his Guru Maharaj, sometime in a dream, he was calling me and I was horrified that I'll have to go away from home. And you'll notice in parentheses, Prabhupada's laughing. He said, when I left home, I left 3 children. He said, now I have 5,000. And any one of them takes better care of me than any one of the 3 kids that I left in home. But Krishna had a much better arrangement. He had a much better arrangement in mind, already laid out, already detailed for Prabhupada, than staying in the family life. So Prabhupada says, at last it happens that I left my home in 1950 and became a missionary. And look at the miracle. It wasn't a perfect situation. He was 70 years old. How many people go to a foreign country at the age of 70 to start a religious movement? It wasn't perfect. It wasn't when Prabhupada was young and hale and hearty. He went at 70. Better late than never, right? And look at the miracle. These are the numbers. These are the numbers. Now, our Krishna conscious movement is based on a high level of morality. Very high level of morality. 4 principles of religion are compassion, truthfulness, cleanliness, and austerity. And we honor these 4 principles in the following way. By not eating meat, by not gambling, by not having illicit sex, and no intoxication. So these are very, very high principles. LDS has 3 of these principles, but they honor the 4th one more in the breach than in the observance, the one about meat eating. So in spite of that, you know, Prabhupada was once asked, how come we don't have more devotees? Prabhupada said, how many people, you know, not many people can do this. Not many people can do this, can live without meat or illicit sex or intoxication and gambling. In spite of that, look at the numbers. 40 farming communities worldwide, 100 vegetarian restaurants, 400 temples, 1 million followers all over the world, and 100,000 in North America. Miracle. And here we come to Arjuna at the end of the Bhagavad Gita. He's heard from Krishna. He's followed all the principles for good decision making. He's prayed for guidance. He's gotten the fact. He's faced his fears. And now you almost feel the hair stand on your head. You almost feel the goosebumps. He says, oh, infallible one, my illusion is now gone. I regain my memory by your mercy. I am now firm and free from doubt, and prepared to act according to your instruction. This is a very different Arjuna than the one in the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita. He's been transformed. And he's now free from doubt. And he's eager and enthusiastic to allow himself to be Krishna's instrument for the good of the world and for the good of the others. So ask yourself, what decision do you need to make? Do something great in your life for Krishna's sake. Don't waste it. Don't be a mediocrity. Don't just exist. Make the 4 decisions that will determine your destiny. What are those 4 decisions? To commit my life to serving Krishna or God. You know, there are many good churches. And becoming a part of his family. If you haven't done that, then what are you waiting on? To not decide is to decide. And second, to make a decision to commit to the habits that will help me grow spiritually. Without being a wishy-washy, lukewarm, shallow devotee. Go head on. Be everything that Krishna wants you to be. Squeeze out of life everything that he wants you to squeeze out. And third, use your talents, gifts, your personality, your experiences, your abilities in serving the Lord. Some of you have been sitting on the bench now, and it's time to get in the game. You've been spectators, it's time to be participators. And then the 4th commitment is to share Krishna consciousness with others. Once you know the good news, then you become a carrier, an ambassador, and a messenger. So this temple here, Prabhupada established the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. There were 108 temples during his time here, and now there are 400 temples. And these are places where you can come and learn about these commitments and help to make those commitments so that you can grow in character and grow in spiritual life. But nothing's going to happen unless you make the decision. We can't make the decision for you. If you make the decision, we're here with all of our resources to help you. But you have to make the decision. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. We've got another one here too. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna.